Welcome to Making a Meal of It, the podcast for eaters of all appetites who want to reimagine and reinvigorate their relationships with food, food culture, and food systems. I'm David Santo, and today's show focuses on buying and selling both food and wine, including the ways in which trust is built up between buyers and sellers, and the ways that that trust and communication and simple human exchange keep our commercial transactions from becoming solely transactional. First, though, a couple of sounds to listen to. Both of those sounds are probably pretty familiar to most of us. The first one is from a self-serve supermarket checkout scanner, the kind that are increasingly appearing in large grocery stores. Statistically speaking, they apparently don't really speed up the checkout process, but we shoppers seem to like them, as do the folks who design our retail experiences. For the consumer, self-checkout suggests a kind of autonomy and control, and a sense, even if it's not true, that we're just not wasting our time in a lineup. For some people, it's also a way to really just to avoid human interaction, like with the checkout person. That's both a symptom of and a driver of the ways in which the gamification and the roboticization of everyday life is creating bigger and bigger social gaps and disconnects between people. Despite knowing that, though, I kind of also enjoy using the self-checkout myself. And I think it's because I always wanted a toy cash register as a kid. And that was partly because I loved the manual dexterity and the memory skills that I saw the grocery store clerks have. It was just so cool, and I wanted to be as smart and cool as them. So operating a cash register, or today a self-checkout machine, kind of gives me that feeling. But even that's kind of weird because now, as an adult, it also drives me further away from watching those checkout people do their thing so well. And making the contradiction even stranger, I really love those daily, small, and caring interactions that I have with other people, whether it's at a shop or at the gym or in the street. It just feels so basic to being human. That second sound was, as you probably guessed, wine pouring from a bottle into a glass. The glug, glug, glug of liquid flowing out and air flowing back up the neck of the bottle is so distinctive. But more figuratively, it's the sound of another impending sensory experience, of the tastes and smells and textures of a nice Zinomavro or Grüner Veltliner rolling around on your tongue and palate. If you listen again, though, you'll also hear another part of that sound, the glass filling up. And it creates a subtle kind of change in pitch as the airspace inside shrinks. Generally speaking, we use our eyes to determine the level of the liquid in a vessel and to keep it from spilling over. But that pitch change is also how we recognize that the glass is filling up. It's a backup or complementary sensory experience that very subtly tells us when to stop the flow. Both of those sounds are examples of feedback. Feedback is how we know that something we did actually had an effect. The beeps of the supermarket scanner tell you that the product was recognized and that it's been added to the bill. And the same thing for the pitch change when you're filling up the glass. And yeah, I'm seeing the level of liquid in the glass is also a form of feedback, but the sound element kind of reinforces the visual. And more generally, if you were, say, filling up a bucket with a hose and not paying much attention, then the changing pitch from the bucket would be a pretty good indicator of when to twist close the valve. Feedback of various sorts is one of the main themes of this episode. I'll come back to it at the end of the show because it ties a lot of things together, and it might be one of the more subtle parts of food culture that we should be paying more attention to. Kicking things off today, I visit the historic Jean Talon Market here in Montreal and talk with the Director General of the Montreal Public Markets. Then I'm off to a wine bar, actually what we call a buvette here in Quebec, one that doubles as a design studio during most days of the week. And during the Stick This in Your Mouth segment, Maxime and I taste a few cheeses, both highly processed and less so. And closing things off, as usual, is the Making a Meal of It food questionnaire. My first guest is Nicolas-Fabien Ouellet, the Director General of the Montreal Public Markets. Nicolas and I met many years ago at a food studies conference in California, and he was presenting some of his master's degree work there on food identity and food systems. Since then, he's been building innovative programs into the public markets of Montreal, making them stronger, more resilient, and more adaptive to the needs of both consumers and food producers who meet up there 7 days a week.
Nicolas, thank you so much for being part of the show. It's so great to be back at the Jean Talon Market. It's been a while since I've been here. I've unfortunately moved out of the neighborhoods and I'm a bit lazy. So like a lot of people, I don't make the effort to come out and do my market shopping as often as I should. I think the markets here really, really hold a special place for Montrealers. Why do you think that is?
Well, the first thing I think is not only Jean Talon Market that we like, we like the network of markets that we're lucky to have in Montreal. And so because of that network, I think we all have some kind of proximity with this type of food offer. That's one of the reasons that we all know them, we all love them. Mm-hmm. This network of market has a rich history. It's almost 100 years old. And so many generations have passed through those markets. And so all of the history is one of the reasons that we love the market in addition to the food offer, obviously. That
Well, they're very much implanted in the Montreal sort of psyche. There's always a really strong sense of community I get when I come here.
Yeah, it's without the market, I don't think that Montreal would be a food metropolis. But I think Montreal is known for its food, for its restaurants. All the great chefs that we have, they will all tell you that they come to the markets to get inspired. They will also get their produce from the market in most of the time. And so if we remove those market, I think we remove a part of the DNA of food in Montreal. In some ways, I think one of the, you know, the heart of Montreal is really about the market.
Yeah. Well, and it goes back not just 100 years, but even longer, because Montreal as a port city, as an inland port city, before the St. Lawrence Seaway anyway, it was the place from which food got imported and exported out of this place we call North America and towards that place called Europe.
And that's fascinating, I think, if we look at the history of markets. These used to be the only places where you can sell food. It was regulated because of sanitary issues. You wanted to cut meat and sell meat, it had to be in a market. And the market still remains today, although we saw the development of what we call supermarkets. The market has survived all these new trends of how we buy and sell food. But still today, they are the heart of the food systems in Montreal, and we still love them.
How do you think that the markets in Montreal, or what role do they play in that bigger food landscape that also includes supermarkets?
For one, these are regional food infrastructure that are essential to short supply chain. These markets are not just about getting the best food to impress your friends. These are crucial for farmers that are in production in or around Montreal that want to sell directly to consumers. And so when we're talking about diversifying our agricultural practices in Quebec, when we're talking about food access, when we're talking about competition in the food world and the retail sector, public markets plays a huge role because they are the only ways to get produce in short supply chains to that many consumers at the same time.
Yeah, so the supermarkets, because they're operating at such a big scale, have to have big scale suppliers, and that excludes an enormous number of the producers who work here in Quebec. And at the same time, I was talking about the need for, if not food sovereignty, a lot more focus on local consumption and local production. If you're always demanding that everyone's producing at this massive scale, it simply can't work.
Correct. And so that's one, I think it's left out of the conversation about food sovereignty, food price increase, and the diversification of our agricultural sector. Without markets, we won't get those objectives completed. That's one way to stabilize food price, diversity of food access, but also to help mitigate climate change with all the benefits that local food supply chains bring.
Yeah. The markets are a kind of complex solution, if you will, to a very complex problem, or a set of very complex problems.
And that's what you get behind your produce that you like to see and interact with the farmers. Well, behind this transaction that you do help a lot about bringing up those localized food systems and supply chains to bring them to scale and preserve them and develop them.
There's a lot of mistrust going on with what's happening with food prices in supermarkets. Do you feel like there's more trust here at the markets, or is there a similar kind of doubt on the part of the consumers about why things are expensive these days?
There's more trust. Now, there's some misunderstanding. As consumers, we often have demands that are not realistic. That said, here, when I talk to producer, they tell me my price of producing food has increased because of gas, because of fertilizer and stuff like that. I'm not going to put all the extra costs on my consumer that I like, because I know they won't be here next year if they do that. And so if I need to increase by $1, often I will increase by 50 cents to make sure that I retain my consumers and build long-term relationship with them.
Yeah, because it is a relationship, and the relationship has to, for them to survive, for consumers to continue to eat well and at an affordable price, has to be an ongoing relationship. It can't just be transactional like it is in a big store.
Exactly. And the consumer here, when they come to a market, they have their connection with the vendors and they are able to ask questions. And that link of confidence and trustworthiness is obviously what distinguish a public market from a generic store.
Yeah. Well, tell me more about what you mentioned earlier, which is this program that you're starting to give greater access, not just to producers, but also to consumers.
There are two programs. The first one is Récolte Engagée, which is a program that uses unsold produce from vendors at markets to provide them to a local organization that will redistribute to families in need. The other one is Tous à Table. And Tous à Table, I do believe strongly in this potential to scale up that type of program, and it's based surrounding increasing purchasing powers of low-income families. What we did as a first project with Desjardins, which is a financial institution in Quebec, Desjardins bought us 50,000 of value of gift certificates that are in place in Montreal's public market. We printed those $50,000 in gift certificate. We provided them to a local organization, and this organization, instead of giving food to the household in need, they gave those gift certificate for Montreal's public market. It's all about purchasing powers, dignity, freedom of choice. And so not only do we tackle hunger, but we help stimulate the local food system. I'm a strong believer of this type of program. I was inspired during my master thesis by this type of program that exists in the US. And so I brought back this idea here. We did a first round with Desjardins, and I'm working on scaling that up with other financial partners to bring it to scale, so to all other public markets in Montreal.
So I'd like to take a look around the market, if you don't mind, and I'd love to have you show me some of your favorite spots or some of the parts of the market that you find most interesting. So we go out and take a look.
For sure. Right now it's harvest time, so it's autumn, and we have a lot of vegetables and fruits to buy right now.
It's my favorite time of year here because everything looks just so plentiful and there's so much product from Quebec. I'm seeing right now cranberries and peppers and aubergine and pumpkins and en masse and like all sorts of other beautiful things. Cabbages, the potatoes are looking gorgeous, the garlic. What's your favorite thing to see at this time of year at the market?
Well, it's just a variety. You can get pretty much everything from berries to root vegetables. And right now we still have about 100 producer vendors on site. And so it's an exciting time of the year to come and experience what is it to shop and to buy and to exchange with vendors at a public market.
Yeah, and to really feel the sense of Quebec's food identity all around us.
For sure, for sure. Here is a second alley that we have, and at the end of this alley, it's a special program that we've put together in the last few years. We provide the stall, and the farmer doesn't have to build anything. And it's a new program. It was a demand for farmers that wanted to come at Jean Talon Market, not for 7 days a week, but just for one day. And so that's one way that we've welcomed about 26 new food businesses and food producers in the past year. Right now you can see we have La Ferme La Fourchette
He's here with his truck. He's just unloading his beets and root vegetables that he still have. And he put them on the stall that we provide. He doesn't have to have like a pop-up tent or a table to carry. He can only focus on producing the best fruit and vegetables and get them here, put them on the table, and so we can just buy them. With this program, what we did is that we just simplified what it is to sell in public markets, and we have a lot of positive feedback about this, and this is one way to help the next generation to not only sell in public market, but also get into production.
I've noticed that there are a lot of subtle but very striking changes. There's different signage. It feels a little bit fresher, a little bit younger. It seems like you've been doing a lot of work to make the whole aesthetic experience of being here even more attractive.
I'll show you the new a new thing that we've put up for the signage, like how you advertise your price and where the food come from, which farms. I'll show you something new over there. So let's take another small walk to see the other alleys.
Great, let's go. So as you told me, there's this new voluntary program for showing the provenance of different foods, and the producers are provided with these stickers or these labels so they can show exactly where their food is coming from, if it is in fact from Quebec or not.
Right, and this new way to advertise where the food comes from and the price, they all respect the Quebec law about saying where the food comes from. For example, the law says if you produce a lettuce, well, we produce lettuce in Quebec, but in the United States they do too, and we cannot know for sure if it's a Quebec produce or not. And so we came up with that new way to advertise, and so it's voluntary, and we have the blue color that says this is from Quebec, the green color that says this is from my farm, and we have also the red color that is a produce from Canada outside Quebec, and we have the gray one, which is import produce, like the lime that we can see over there.
Yeah, and this is, I mean, it's a wonderful way to show the different provenances, but it's also in some ways a kind of consumer education move, because if you go into a supermarket, for example, the food is, as we classically say, food from nowhere. It's food from a generic place. Sometimes they have a place of origin. Often fruits and vegetables have stickers on them. It's not always, you know, not always confident that those stickers are telling the truth, but here there's a sense of, okay, there's very local, there's quite local, there's a bit local, and there's not so local. And that's something that I think many food buyers don't tend to think about habitually when they go grocery shopping. It's the good old-fashioned technique of communication and trust, which is absent in so many places in so many parts of our world these days, particularly in food.
Whereas in markets, public markets, farmers market, this is one of the reasons why we go there and why we like them. So one thing that I personally love about markets is that they are dynamic. They change throughout the year and throughout the season. And so right now we're in October, so it's full of vegetables and fruit. But if you come in May and even in April, you'll get flowers, you get seedlings for your gardening, and this side of the market is full with flowers and plant and producers that are not there at this time of the year in October, but they have been there at the beginning of the season. And so it's dynamic, it changes not only in terms of produce, of product, but also in terms of farmers and vendors that are on the market. And so you have to come often to really understand the whole market experience.
It is, as you say, it's dynamic. It changes throughout the year, just like food changes throughout the year. But we don't see that in supermarkets. We see the same stuff over and over again. And here what we're seeing is a kind of representation of the natural world changing around us, or the farmed world changing around us, and then coming into the market and manifesting itself.
This is the whole thing about market, is you have to come often to understand these ways of getting the best product that you want, or that special price, or that quantity of product that you need. So you really have to come often to understand your market and get the most out of it.
Yeah, in many ways what you're saying is this is a relationship as much as it is a food selling location.
Correct, and that relationship to really have it, like, to make the most out of it, you have to talk to your vendor, and you'll find your vendors, your farmer that you prefer. They will give you tips. They will tell you, like, come in 3 days, I'll get this new variety, and be there at this time, because it won't last long, and you'll be able to get it, show it to your friends, and have really that whole experience about market.
And don't forget to check out our show notes for details about Nicolas' background and research, as well as the history of the public markets in Montreal. Up next is Tania Perrault, co-owner and operator with her partner Mélisande Lefebvre of La Perrault Buvette. As a wine bar on Thursday and Friday nights and a commercial design studio during the rest of the time, La Perrault has created a kind of sustainable ecosystem of commerce. One business balances the other, while the owners get to share their deep and abiding love of natural wines without burning themselves out.
Alors, merci beaucoup, Tania, d'avoir accepté de participer à ce podcast. Je suis fasciné par votre entreprise.
Oui, en fait, La Perrault Buvette a été conçu d'un projet où, justement, je me cherchais un espace pour créer mon bureau de design. Donc, ça fait plus de 13 ans que je conçois, je dessine des espaces commerciaux, restos, bars, café, centre de yoga pour les autres, pour les clients. Et je devais me trouver un bureau, je savais pas où le faire, dans un studio, dans un tour ou pignon sur rue. Puis j'ai décidé de le faire dans un endroit où ça m'inspire le plus. C'est-à-dire, j'aime apporter mon laptop dans des restaurants, dans des cafés, justement pour m'inspirer de l'espace. Donc, je me suis dit, je vais créer mon bureau dans un projet qui serait propre à moi, dans un bar, un petit buvette, pourquoi pas. Donc, c'est comme ça que c'est né.
Mais c'est fascinant. C'est vraiment un espace très confortable, chouette. C'est vraiment, évidemment, c'est bien designé. Mm. Mais pour nos auditeurs anglophones, est-ce que tu peux expliquer le concept d'une buvette?
Drôle de mot, en fait, pour décrire un petit espace où on partage le vin avec les gens du quartier. C'est comme ça, moi, je le décris. C'est vraiment une buvette. Pour moi, c'est pas un bar, parce qu'ici, on sert pas les cocktails. C'est vraiment une passion, un partage de tout ce qui est comme vin, prendre l'apéro dans un endroit convivial. Moi, je suis pas du tout sommelière. Je suis juste fascinée par le vin depuis mon très jeune âge. Mon père, il en faisait, avec la petite poudre, là. Il écrasait pas les raisins avec ses orteils, là, mais bref, il faisait quand même goûter ses créations. Et Mel, ma conjointe avec qui j'ai le projet de la buvette, elle avant buvait beaucoup de bière, puis elle a développé une intolérance, entre autres, au sulfite. Mais elle aimait le goût de la bière, le goût du blé, le goût naturel, puis elle aimait le vin, mais ça lui créait beaucoup de nausées. Donc, elle a découvert qu'il existait des vins nature. Ouais. Elle s'est comme vraiment intéressée à tout cet univers, puis elle en a créé une obsession, une passion, puis c'est pour ça qu'ici, on a principalement des vins nature d'importation privée, des trucs exclusifs qu'on peut pas trouver nulle part pour justement
Mais la première fois que
partager.
Je suis venu, j'étais ébobi par la sélection, la variété, parce que c'est vraiment une gamme exceptionnelle de vins nature. Et puisqu'on sait que toutes sortes de gens qui entrent dans ce domaine-là, qui ne sont pas vraiment des experts dans la production de vins nature, mais les produits ici sont de qualité exceptionnelle, je trouve.
Ah ouais, mais c'est vraiment ça, c'est tout le travail que je lui accorde à Mel, là. Tu sais, on a des vins libanais, japonais, slovéniens, ainsi de suite. Ça sort complètement du standard qu'on reconnaît par les Français puis les Italiens. On explore différentes saveurs, différentes vignes, justement. Donc
oui, ce sont des produits qui ne sont pas nécessairement trouvables autre part, mais c'est aussi un concept qui n'est pas vraiment trouvable autre part. Je ne connais pas plusieurs endroits où il y a un mélange d'un espace public et d'un espace privé. C'est un studio de design, mais c'est aussi une buvette, un bar à vin. Mm-hmm. Et c'est un modèle d'affaires qui est aussi assez innovateur. C'est, pour moi au moins, c'est quelque chose de vraiment nouveau. Est-ce que c'est toujours un défi de trouver cette tension juste entre la rentabilité pour les propriétaires et puis l'abordabilité pour les clients, en particulier dans un contexte de consommation d'alcool où il y a beaucoup de frais en sus pour acheter une bouteille qui vient d'ailleurs?
Le fait de partager l'espace avec un bureau de design qui est une entreprise en soi et la buvette qui est ouverte juste deux soirs, ça nous permet de justement offrir à des clients des produits et des vins plus abordables parce qu'on n'a pas le stress financier d'être d'une grande rentabilité. Donc, nous, on veut vraiment créer un espace où les gens viennent découvrir, échanger autant la passion du design parce que c'est un endroit quand même inspirant que la passion pour le vin, puis avec les gens du quartier. On ne fait pas beaucoup de promotion, on ne veut pas que ça devienne trop volumineux ou comme inaccessible non plus. On ne veut pas rentrer dans une échelle de prix trop élevée pour faire plus de profit. Notre modèle d'affaires, c'est vraiment comme on veut faire découvrir le plus possible pour moins. Tu sais.
Mm-hmm. Donc, c'est une espèce d'écosystème ou d'écologie que vous avez créé entre la buvette, le studio design, la communauté, et puis aussi tout ce qui est affaires et business et marketing dans le monde de restauration, de provision de comestibilité, des choses
comme ça. Exactement.
Donc, c'est vraiment... C'est délicat, mais même ça, j'imagine que c'est plus stable que les autres restos, les autres bars. Et j'imagine peut-être que c'est aussi une espèce de modèle pour les autres compagnies, les autres entreprises qui veulent...
Exactement. Il y a un des plus gros défis aussi dans le monde de la restauration. Puis ça, j'en discute beaucoup avec mes clients parce que je suis en train de faire plusieurs restaurants pour d'autres clients. Et ça reste le staff, l'équipe de travail, de trouver son personnel, autant gérant, plongeur, chef cuisinier, assistant, serveur. De plus en plus, les gens, ils font du travail comme moins manuel, ils vont être plus comme derrière l'ordinateur, en marketing. Tu sais, il y a d'autres moyens de faire sa carrière que d'aller en restauration. Donc, je trouve que notre modèle, une petite surface où c'est juste moi puis Mel, on est les deux propriétaires, il n'y a pas de gestion de personnel, donc il y a un meilleur contrôle aussi, tu sais, autant sur le service qu'on rend aux gens, tu sais, on se retrouve souvent, des fois, on va prendre un café, on se fait mal servir, notre expérience client reste marquée après sur cette institution quand, dans le fond, c'est pas tant l'institution le problème, mais c'est le personnel, tu sais, donc... C'est un gros défi pour un restaurateur quand même.
Ouais, j'imagine. Ouais, et puis s'il y a jamais une question de service, de changement de qualité de service, c'est juste une conversation, c'est pas un long processus de formation aux autres.
Non, c'est ça.
Donc est-ce que le fait que l'espace sert comme bureau pendant la plupart de la semaine et puis comme buvette deux soirées sur sept, est-ce que ça change vos relations spatiales et sociales ici dedans? Quels sont vos rapports ou même envers l'espace ici?
Au niveau bureau de design, quand j'invite mes clients dans l'espace, ils sont tout de suite comme soit charmés ou rassurés, comme quoi que, OK, ben oui, elle fait du design pour nous, mais elle est capable de le faire pour elle. Puis c'est comme une salle de montre aussi. Tu sais, on a une matériothèque en arrière, on peut offrir un verre de vin. C'est quand même pratique, tu sais, à certains niveaux.
Ouais.
puis la buvette de quartier... ce que j'aime beaucoup, c'est justement, on l'a créé pas juste pour nous, mais pour les gens autour. Donc, on aime ce rapport de fidélisation entre avec nos clients. T'sais, c'est vraiment un lieu de rassemblement comme de plusieurs milieux, autant le design que dans n'importe quel domaine. Le lien entre les deux est intéressant. Le plus difficile, je dirais, c'est d'arrêter mon travail de design une fois à 3-4 heures pour changer de tablier, changer de costume, puis on...
Est-ce que c'est aussi un changement de manière de penser et de réagir au monde? Parce que servir des gens à une bar, c'est différent que parler avec vos clients de design.
Ouais. Mais pendant mes études en design, j'ai quand même été en service. Donc, c'est vraiment quelque chose que j'ai dans le cœur et dans le sang. J'adore être entourée de monde, puis de rendre une expérience inoubliable en service. C'est pas juste, je viens vous apporter... votre repas, votre verre de vin. Je m'intéresse, on jase, on explique, on explore. Puis après, ben les gens reviennent, donc on les reconnaît par leur nom. Donc, on crée vraiment comme un sentiment d'appartenance, tu sais, un lieu de rassemblement un peu « homey », là, si on peut dire. C'est comme si on invitait les gens chez nous.
Donc, tu as parlé un peu de la passion, l'amour que vous partagez pour le vin, toi et Mélissandre. Mm-hmm. Est-ce que vous êtes en train aussi de découvrir d'autres amours dans le vin? Est-ce qu'il y a des régions ou des espèces que vous désirez explorer en davantage?
Constamment. Ouais. Je pense que c'est le but de l'ouverture de la buvette, c'était de justement pas être limité par qu'est-ce qu'on peut avoir dans les institutions plus gouvernementales, si on peut dire. Puis notre objectif, c'est d'aller visiter aussi les vignerons, puis d'aller découvrir par nous-mêmes, tu sais, différentes régions qui produisent de ce type de vin pour peut-être demander à les agences de les importer. Tu sais, c'est vraiment comme vraiment une vraie passion là, du vin.
Ouais. C'est une manière de découvrir tout ça qui existe dans le monde, qui est un peu moins connu.
Ouais, exact.
Cool. Qu'est-ce que vous pensez à propos du futur de la consommation du vin versus, par exemple, les cocktails, les bières, les nouveaux cocktails non alcoolisés, tout ça?
Je trouve que les cocktails, c'est intéressant, mais c'est sûr que c'est plus long à faire. T'sais. Ça demande plus d'ingrédients, c'est plus de recherche. On a rencontré une cliente qui est venue ici, puis elle essayait de trouver des façons innovatrices de créer un cocktail, mettons, goût de tomate, mais qui était vert. Puis c'est comme, OK, bon, on part dans différents univers, mais c'est vrai, les gens, ils cherchent des expériences. T'sais. Autant au niveau du vin, le vin, on connaît les Français, les Italiens, bon, les Américains, Californie, tu sais, on reconnaît leur cépage. Mais avec le vin, ce qui est le fun aussi, autant avec les cocktails, c'est qu'on peut explorer dans différentes saveurs. Tu sais, il y a des vins qui sont plus à base de gasoline, qui va goûter la levure, bon, le goût de framboise, canneberge, pomme grenade. Tu sais, on explore autant avec le vin qu'avec les cocktails, je trouve.
Ouais. Et moi, je trouve que, en partie dans vos vins, dans les vins nature, mais aussi les vins que vous offrez ici, sont un peu comme des cocktails de temps en temps, parce que les cocktails sont à base, c'est un mélange équilibré.
Ouais.
Est-ce que tu penses que les gens répondent aux vins nature dans le même sens qu'ils répondent aux nouveaux cocktails qui sont offerts sur plusieurs
mois? Tout à fait. Il y a des gens qui aiment pas le vin, qui ont une appréhension, ils disent, mais j'aime pas le blanc parce que ça goûte tel truc, j'aime pas le rouge parce que nana. Mais ils aiment les cocktails. Fait que parfois, on a des vins ouverts où on va sentir plus le côté tropical, tu sais, plus moins fruité avec la petite amertume d'une bière. Puis il y a même des vins qui évoluent aussi, qu'à l'ouverture, il y a de certaines arômes, puis plus on boit la bouteille, plus le vin a respiré, a pris de l'oxygène, puis il y a comme... il développe autre chose, tu sais. Ouais. Fait que tout ça, c'est vraiment... ça fait partie d'une expérience au niveau du vin.
Une des choses que j'admire beaucoup sur votre menu, c'est les catégories de vins. Il y a des vins qui sont plus funky, il y a des vins qui sont non-genrés. Est-ce que tu penses que tu participes à une évolution du langage qui décrit le vin?
Oui, tout à fait. Ben, justement, le fait qu'on n'est pas sommelière ni une ni l'autre, qu'on est juste passionné de vin. On n'a pas la formation avec les mots justes nécessairement, donc on décrit le vin vraiment comme nous on le ressent, puis justement on aime quand les gens partagent également comment vous voyez le vin, c'est quoi, qu'est-ce que vous sentez, qu'est-ce que vous goûtez, où ça va chercher dans la bouche, et c'est vraiment un échange naturel dans le fond de l'expression du vin qu'on boit là.
Ouais, puis ça, je pense que ça ajoute beaucoup à la familialité,
oui, familiarité,
la simplicité qui est présentée par l'apéro. Merci beaucoup de m'avoir parlé de ce sujet magnifique et fascinant et très réconfortant en même temps. C'était un plaisir.
Ça fait plaisir.
Merci.
For more about L'Apéro, both the buvette and the design business, check out their websites at laperobuvette.com and studioperro.com. We'll be right back.
So, welcome back to Stick This in Your Mouth with my partner, Maxime. Hi, Maxime.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm fine. How are you?
Are you looking forward to eating more disgusting things?
Not really.
Yes, but I'm grateful that you're doing it anyway. Okay. So, last week, it was all about the terrors of bananas. And you survived.
I did.
Do you have any reflections on eating a banana that you'd like to share with the audience?
It wasn't as bad as I thought it would be, but I'm not enough for me to eat bananas again.
But is it opening you up to the idea that some things are not as bad as you think that they might be?
Of course.
All right. So this week, when we're looking at cheese, to quote Wallace and Gromit, how do you feel about cheese?
Not well. I really don't like cheese.
Why don't you like cheese?
Once again, it's all about texture.
Okay, so it's like chewy, gummy.
Chewy, gummy, or somewhat rubbery, or springy, or any kind of...
dances in your mouth.
And also certain more pronounced cheese have a taste that I'm not fond of, like any kind of Roquefort or Bleu.
Yeah. So what is it? What is it about the taste that you don't like?
Excellent question. I'm not sure I have... It's not my favorite taste.
It's not your favorite taste. You're like, you gross, get it away from me.
Yes, okay, you gross, get it away. But also smelly cheeses, because I associate the smell with the taste, even though sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah. Taste is, you know, what goes on our tongue, and smell is what goes on our nose, and flavor is what we experience when we actually eat. And a lot of people find the flavors or the aromas of blue cheese like smells like feet. Is it something else?
No, it's feet. It's the feet.
And you're not into eating feet? Come on. Okay, so grilled cheese, croque monsieur.
Yes.
Fondue?
Yes, I've had fondue, but like a little bit.
All right, so we've got some cheeses on the table.
Yes, a little too much for my taste.
So what are you seeing on the board right now?
I'm seeing blue cheese. I'm seeing some kind of processed cheese. I'm seeing some kind of Parmesan, and the other one I cannot identify. Oh, it's Boursin. Okay.
What's your favorite?
Boursin, I love. Because it's not really cheese.
Well, yet it is. This blue cheese is actually a Campazola, which I discovered in the 1980s. I thought it was the most miraculous thing that had ever been created, some weird hybrid of Camembert and Gorgonzola, and it is a wonderful cheese. So I'm going to make you look at it and maybe try tasting some of it. We'll see. And then, the other one's a Parmesan. It's not Parmesan because it's made in Estonia, but at our local cheese shop. We're going to try that and see what happens. What does it smell like to you?
It reminds me of Parmesan, but also... something like a cheddar?
Yeah.
It's vaguely reminiscent of Parmesan, like a real...
Yeah.
The Parmesan thing is kind of an exception for me. Like, I would have, like, I would shave some of it on a salad and eat that and be okay with it and being perfectly fine. But this has a very different texture than other cheeses, is that it's relatively dry. It crumbles easily. It's not springy in the mouth. It's tasty, but it's mildly tasty. Okay. It's not like a super strong smell, and it doesn't smell like feet.
Gross. Okay, so that's the Campazola. You don't need to eat it, but like, what do you get when you put it in your fingers?
Well, it's sticky and gooey and.
Okay, hand over the cheese. I'm going to stick it in my mouth. Yum, yum, yum. Takes me back to my childhood. Okay, so what I really am interested in doing is this experiment between two highly processed cheeses. One is Boursin, kind of cream cheese with herbs and garlic in it. And the other is this perfectly horrifying looking orange processed cheese. And it's basically Cheese Whiz, but it's a Quebecois version of Cheese Whiz. And the first time I encountered this, someone said, oh, you've got to try it. It's so good. It's like, yeah, it's Cheese Whiz. Let's see if I can get this open. Oh, there it is. Ooh, it's got some texture. So we've got two processed cheeses.
Yeah.
One, delightful, Boursin. It's our weekend treat.
Yeah. It is a very familiar taste. I've been eating this for a very long time. Mm-hmm. I discovered this when I moved to Montreal. Yeah. I'd rather prefer the Bourcelain than a regular cream cheese on bagel. That's my personal taste.
Yeah, it's lighter. It's a little more aerated.
And there's some flavoring now. So, mm-hmm. And it's a very interesting and easy to eat kind of cheese. Yum.
Yeah. Okay.
So try the... That's an awful lot in a spoon. First of all, the color is really not attractive. Any kind, when I see it, like a really orange cheddar, I just like, it's just not a color that I find attractive. And I am very scared to taste this. After the Bourcelain, it doesn't taste like anything.
Yeah, it tastes kind of salty and a little bit nothing. But it's not even as strong as cheese whiz. Cheese whiz I find very strong. This is sort of just like, sort of there. That is quintessentially gooey and gummy and gross.
Yeah, which is all stuff I'm not fond of on top of the orange color. So it's a pass for me. Not a hard pass, but it's just like not...
But it's not, but it's so interesting, right? Because it's the same, it's basically the same kind of concept as Bourcelain. It just has a very different look.
It feels slick in the mouth. It feels oily. It feels not the natural state of cheese.
Right.
Okay. We were always joking about cheese whiz, saying that there was more whiz than cheese. Cheese whiz.
Well, I think this is probably about 98% whiz, but it's whiz local.
Yes.
Ça vient d'ici.
Yay.
All right. Well, I appreciate your time once again and your bravery.
Thank you.
Merci à toi.
Bye.
So what is it about getting feedback from a given situation that's so important? And is the feedback we get from real live human beings different or more valuable than the feedback we get from machines or other non-living things? The beep, beep, beep of a checkout scanner lets us know we've passed the barcode across the laser beams correctly, as does the appearance of a product name and price on the checkout screen. And the sound of liquid pouring into a glass and the pitch changes we hear tell us we've aimed correctly and that we'll eventually need to stop tipping the bottle. Feedback from another person, though, it does something more subtle, I think. It transcends the simple mechanics of knowing that we've made a gesture. Those verbalizations and eye contact and smiles or even frowns, all the vibes we get from someone we're interacting with, they build up foundations of trust relationships. We know that our presence, our words, our emotions, and our actions or our gestures have been sensed and respected and perhaps valued. More importantly, reciprocal feedback gives both the buyers and sellers of food a sense of complicity, of being in it together, whatever it is, a relationship, a moment, whatever. And that human trust relationship then extends to the food and drink we're interacting over. So being in a relationship with people helps us be in better relationships with our food. For Nicolas Fabien Ouellette at the Montreal Public Markets, the feedback relationships with his vendors help him support new small-scale farmers. The feedback that they exchange with shoppers at the market adds value to the food that's being bought and sold. The signage about food origins tells buyers what to expect. And when they crunch into some local lettuce or eat a freshly steamed Quebecois fingerling potato, that sensory feedback in their mouths and stomachs goes back and reinforces the trust that people have for their markets. Then, for example, over at L'Apéro Buvette, the ways that Tanya and Mélissane suggest and share and describe their wines, they start off a feedback cycle when their customers take the first sip. The conversations across the bar top that also doubles as a conference table during the day ground the experience in the visual truths of the space. This is a wine bar conceived around pleasure and exchange, not just a commerce, not just a business. And then what about Maxime and his ongoing discomfort with eating cheese, whether it's blue or orange? In his case, the sensory feedback he gets from solidified dairy tends to reinforce his childhood dislikes. When cheese is invisibilized, however, in a gratin or a sauce, those cues melt away and maybe a new kind of taste relationship can enter the scene. Maybe Maxime can learn to trust cheese. Whatever the case, I think it's worth de-insulating ourselves from feedback, getting closer to the people and objects that can give it to us. Letting ourselves both receive and also give feedback directly is a really important part of staying connected, staying well, most of all, staying human. And just for the record, giving a thumbs up or a like on an app isn't really the feedback I'm talking about. No, but that's me. We end the show as usual with the Making a Meal of It food questionnaire. As promised, our responders come from the worlds of art, politics, social change, and science. Eaters, all of them, but folks who don't necessarily work directly with or in food. Their answers are intended to prompt you to think about what your own responses might be to the same questions, a little moment of reflection while digesting the more detailed conversations you've just heard. This week, our food questionnaire responder is the Honorable Sheila Malcolmson, a political and social changemaker par excellence. Sheila is a former member of the Canadian Federal Parliament, representing Nanaimo Ladysmith in British Columbia, and she's currently a member of the Provincial Legislative Assembly of British Columbia, where she serves as Minister of Social Development and Poverty Reduction after having previously served as Minister of Mental Health and Addictions. As we recorded her responses to the food questionnaire, she described herself as feeling determined, playful, and grateful. Sheila, what is your idea of a perfect food?
Pumpkin pie would be my go-to. You can have it for breakfast, lunch, or dinner.
Of what food or food context are you afraid or distrustful?
In my occupation, things that spill on your shirt.
What word or concept describes a well-balanced food system?
Local, local, and local.
What word or concept describes why food systems often remain unbalanced?
Inequity.
Which food person do you most admire?
Loaves and Fishes here in Nanaimo, and its executive director, Peter Sinclair.
Which food innovation do you try to ignore?
Peeled things that don't need to be peeled, like boiled eggs or bananas.
What is your greatest gastronomic extravagance?
Chocolate cake.
For what do you hunger?
And right now, chocolate cake.
On what occasion do you feign satiety?
Apple crisp.
What do you most dislike about dinner tables?
Flower vases that block the view of my friends.
What is the quality you most like in a fruit?
Juiciness.
What is the quality you most like in a cut of meat?
Thick.
Which condiments do you most overuse?
That would have to be yellow mustard.
What kinds of gardens make you happiest?
Wild-looking, bountiful flowers with a little kale mixed in.
Which culinary skill would you most like to have?
I'd like to be able to make a souffle.
If you could change one thing about nutrition, what would it be?
I would pack even more iron content into black licorice.
What do you consider your greatest edible achievement?
Also pumpkin pie.
If you were to die and come back as an edible animal, vegetable, or mineral, what would you like it to be?
For lack of a better choice, carrot.
Where and or when would you most like to dine?
Always on the beach at sunset.
What is your most treasured kitchen implement?
The cheese peeler.
What is your favorite highly processed food?
Pringle chips.
What is your favorite aroma?
Chocolate cake while baking.
What spice, kitchen implement, or cookbook do you use most rarely?
Although I grew up with it and I still have it on the shelf, it would have to be the joy of cooking.
What do you most value in your friend's food?
Abundance.
Who are your favorite food writers?
Hollyhock, all their cookbooks.
Who are your favorite food celebrities?
Brenda Gertner, who may not be a celebrity to many people, but she's a fantastic and generous cook and gets me to her table for most Sunday dinners.
With which cuisine do you most identify?
West Coast fusion.
What is your most powerful sense?
A sense of smell.
What are your favorite agricultural, culinary, or gastronomic words?
Delish.
What would you eat as your second to last meal?
Also pumpkin pie.
What food-related epitaph would you put on your own tombstone?
She had enough.
And that wraps it up for now. Thank you again to Nicolas-Fabien Ouellette, Tania Perrault, Maxime Giroux, and Sheila Malcolmson. To all the people I interact with every day when I go food shopping, and of course to you for listening today. For news and updates, check out makingamealofit.com or follow us at Making a Meal Podcast on most social media platforms. If you have the time, rate and review us. Your feedback is always welcome, of course. Next week, we'll be hearing from three people with various progressive perspectives on both being and eating fat. From the politics and activism around body positivity and diversity to the rather surprising nutritional qualities of pork lard, we're getting closer to a subject that sometimes seems a little hard to chew on. In the meantime, as has been said across countless tables, Kanpai and buon appetito!